Okay, we lied. This show is not about remembering Myron Graham. Some funny little obstacles like Hurricane Sandy got in our way. But we promise you, we'll make it up to you. Stay tuned. Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque, and you are listening to the Ears on Art segment of Issues and Ideas, hosted here at Public Radio KCBX, serving Southern Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties. In a little switcheroo, we had promised you that we would honor the memory of Myron Graham, who passed away last month. But because one of the guest speakers that we wanted to have on the show was stuck in New York because of Hurricane Sandy, we had to move the interview up so it will be aired for the two shows in the month of December. Which means that our typical December show, which is about Christmas reminiscences, is now going to be today. Except for in a little switcheroo, we are going to be talking about other things. Most importantly, the joy of receiving. Co-host Krissa Hewitt and I, and guest Zet Harper, are relaying some stories. Krissa's and mine are from true life. Zet's stories are fables, one Jewish and one Asian. So, with no further ado, here is Krissa Hewitt.
Hi, I am Krissa Hewitt. We've all learned the story many times about the dog who was unable to learn a new trick. I'm not sure that humans are all that more adept. This turning of the tables on giving and receiving certainly has been a challenge for me. I sure am grateful for the people along the way who have pointed me at times in a different direction. Wish I could say I've mastered this one, but I think it's a lifelong journey. A cultural value well ingrained in the majority of us is that it is far better to give than to receive. My father taught me early about the fun of giving, the pleasure of the search for the right present. This was not about a search in a department store, but rather the journey in my mind of what could strike that chord of shared experience, that best attempt to say, "Remember when?" Or, "I heard you," or, "This is why you matter so much." There is great joy when it is obvious that my gift delivered the desired message. But there is the other side of this process, that of being able to receive. My clear wake-up call with the challenge of being the gracious recipient was in 1990. I was leaving the hospital after a rather scary experience with an intestinal obstruction. I was now, though weak, feeling like a new person with a large sense that I was capable of doing anything. As the packing of the belongings proceeded, it was soon clear that even sitting in a wheelchair, I could not carry all the plants. A friend suggested that she take some in her car and drop them at the house. I began the ritual response of, "You don't need to do that. It would be far too much trouble." "Why can't you just let me help you?" came the forceful reply. I looked up and said, "Thank you," with no added buts. There was a big smile in return. This had not been my first lesson in the art of graceful acceptance. This is proving to be a long road. 2 years before, in 1988, I was in Pietrasanta, Italy, for a month learning to carve marble. This was my second summer over there. One day the instructor walked by and looked at my partially carved sculpture and said, "Bueno, bueno." "Grazie," I replied in a non-resounding voice. He moved on and I realized that it was the language barrier that limited me to this one appropriate word. The rest of me was carrying on an elaborate internal response filled with buts and I'm not sures, none of which he was waiting for or wanting to hear. I returned to Pietrasanta in 2002 in what turned out to be a six-summer ritual. Unfortunately, my foreign language skills are next to zero, so I was dependent on translations to do much of the speaking for me. An American woman runs the workshops, and she hires the incredibly talented craftsmen to assist us in the carving. These men, now in their 60s, have been doing this work since they were teens. They are not artists, but have spent their lives bringing to life the ideas of others. Almost without exception, they work from clay or plaster models to render the art in marble. For the most part, I do not work from models or maquettes. I select a stone that speaks to me in some way and start from there. In order to help these men understand what I needed from them, I would create a rough clay model and/or draw on the stone. In the early stages of a piece, this helped them to know where to cut to assist in the removal of large areas of stone. From there, I worked pretty much on my own. Because I am such a lover of process, it was difficult to have them demo on my piece, but I would hold my hands behind my back so that I would stop and pay good attention to what I was being taught. Other students were often very willing to let these men do a considerable amount of the work on their sculptures. Carving marble is not easy, and at the end of the day, you are well aware that you have toiled hard. However, I was creating as I was going, and often not sure where that was. The choices are subtle and often not known to me until I am there. Trying to communicate this in another language was something I could not do except in very general terms. I know that the men were asked to not work on my sculptures unless I was there directing the activity. To my horror, I learned at the end of the workshop in 2003 that through translation, this independence had been interpreted in a way that caused me deep pain. The workshops always ended with a celebration dinner. This year, it happened at the beginning of the last week as two students had to leave early. After the meal, we would be presented with certificates documenting our participation, and the Italian instructor would say something about each of us. These thoughts would be translated by Lynn, the workshop coordinator. When my turn came, Livio began giving nice praise of my art and my hard work. Then he said how sorry he was that he had not been able to work with me on the piece, that he had felt rather useless. I fought back the tears. Somehow the message was not that I was trying to find my way, but that I did not need him. How could I undo this hurt? By this stage in the game, the piece was fully formed but needed polishing. The stone was 4 feet long and a couple of feet wide in some places. Full of concave and convex curves, polishing needed to be done by hand. I was at the early rough grit stoning stage. The work was supported horizontally on a table, which made for good access to all the highs and lows in the form. Livio was there when I arrived in the morning. We hugged, and I handed him a chunk of abrasive stone and pointed to one end of the piece. I started at the other. He smiled, and together we put our elbow grease to work, removing tool marks and defining the curves. We were a team for several hours, until someone else needed him. He had a bout with cancer later that year, which he survived, but did not return to teaching. I would see him in following years and had the pleasure of interviewing him for this program. The setting was his home, and earlier I had seen his studio. In Pietrasanta, he is a rare breed of being a traditional craftsman, rendering the artistic ideas of others, and being an artist in his own right. One of his sculptures is in my living room, where I see it every day. It is a work full of pathos and is a continual reminder of his passion and depth. The learning how to receive lesson is taking hold slowly, but the rewards are impressive enough as to almost blot out my fear of being viewed as greedy and/or totally egotistical.
I'm Zet Harbor, and I'm a storyteller. Long ago, in Japan, there lived a powerful samurai. He was well known for his fierceness and his cruel and ruthless heart. And one day, he decided to travel to the home of a monk. And this monk, known far and wide for his gentleness, his wisdom, and his compassion, was sitting in his room, enjoying a cup of tea. The samurai stormed up to the home, pushed the door open rudely, and demanded that the monk tell him, "What is the difference between heaven and hell? Upon pain of death, tell me now." The monk merely continued to sip his tea, taking in the aroma, enjoying the warmth. Meanwhile, the samurai stood beside him, growing more and more furious and impatient. He stomped his foot. "I ordered you to answer my question. Tell me now, what is the difference between heaven and hell, or I will cut your head off?" The monk merely gently set his cup down, poured yet a little more, and raised the cup back up to his lips. At that, the samurai lost control, and he gripped his sword, and he raised it over his head to deal the fatal blow. "That is hell," said the monk. The samurai heard these quiet words, and slowly he grew to understand that this small, gentle man had risked his life to give him not just an answer, but the awareness. And as he felt this, his heart grew warm and open, and he felt such gratitude and happiness. And the monk said, "And that is heaven." So for me, this story is a great way to show how we never know where the lesson will come from. And if we simply open ourselves to receive the lesson in the way it's coming, or the message in the way that it's coming, that our lives will be better and our hearts will be enriched.
If you have just joined us, you are listening to Ears on Art and our slightly early holiday storytelling segment. We return to guest storyteller Zet Harbor with her second story about the joys of receiving.
I have another story that comes from the tradition of Jewish folklore. It's a story about King Solomon. Many years ago in his kingdom, there lived a beggar woman. And every morning, she would get up from her place where she slept and make her way through the city to a certain corner where she would sit and hold out her hand. And she would call out, "Alms for the poor, alms for the poor." And one after another, people passing by would put a coin into her hand. And when she had enough, just enough for what she needed, she would take her coins and make her way back. And on this day, on her way back, she passed a bakery. The door was open, and the wonderful aromas of that bread came floating out. And she was so hungry. She stood there, entranced, as she breathed in those delicious smells. It was transporting, and she stood there with her eyes closed, just enjoying those delicious flavors through those smells. Meanwhile, the baker was inside, and he watched this old woman standing in front of his doorway with her eyes closed, sniffing the air, and he became very impatient with her. And finally, he couldn't stand it anymore. He went outside, and he looked at her, and he said, "Old woman, what are you doing there?" "Oh, "You bake the most amazing bread," she said. "Why, I feel just smelling it that I'm all tasting exactly what it must be like. It is so delicious. You must be a wonderful baker." "Yes, well, I am the baker, and I own that bread. I own the smells of the bread, and now you owe me money, so pay up." "But I don't understand. I never even stepped foot in your shop. I touched nothing." "I own the smells of the bread. Now you owe me money." And as they argued back and forth, a crowd soon drew around, and everyone had an opinion, but no one had the answer. So they took their problem to the court of King Solomon, and they waited their turn, and finally, the baker was able to tell the king how he had been wronged by this beggar woman. The king listened to his story, and he looked at the old woman, and he said, "Do you have any money at all?" "Just this much," she said, and she shook her hand, and everyone in the room could hear the coins jingling. King Solomon turned to the baker. "Well, you have been paid." "But I don't understand. I don't have the coins in my hand." "Ah, it is the sound of the money that pays for the smell of the bread."
Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque, and this is a story of how I ended up on a turkey ranch in the Sierra Nevada foothills. When I was a junior in high school, my parents moved from Lompoc, where my father had served in the Air Force at Vandenberg, to a 10-acre parcel 8 miles outside of Sonora, a bucolic town of 2,500 sitting in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Our house in Lompoc sold unexpectedly fast, so we had only 30 days to pack up and move. My parents had expected a 3 or 4 month warning of the impending move, which meant that we would be moving in the month of February, instead of the more welcoming months of May or June. The other development was that the house we were moving to was only partially finished. The exterior walls and the roof were finished, but the interior walls were just framed. The electricity had not yet been connected. There were 2 operating sinks in the house, but no operating toilets. And one other obstacle? The road up to the house had been washed out the previous month, so the only access to the house was over a pine log spanning the chasm of the washed-out culvert. Needless to say, the move was an experience not soon forgotten. Most of the furniture went into storage, and only the basic necessities were ferried over the log bridge and up to the house. Because there was no electricity, the wall heaters were useless. We relied on the fireplace in the living room to provide the only heat. We all slept, fully clothed, in refrigerator boxes on the plywood floor, in our sleeping bags, laid out in a semicircle with the open end of the boxes facing the fireplace. Cooking and the heating of wash water were done on a camp stove located just outside of the side door to the house. Sheets were hung to create a private area where we could change our clothes, which were stored in cardboard boxes with our names scrawled on the side. It had snowed 2 days after our arrival, so trips to the outhouse, which was located 50 yards down the hill, were well orchestrated. Since it was winter, the dawn came late and the dusk came early. Nighttime trips to the outhouse were made even more adventurous because of the freezing temperatures. Flashlights and heavy boots were requirements, and no one ever went alone. The contractor who was building the house was doing his best to get the house into a livable condition. Because the plans for the house called for an elevated wraparound porch on 3 sides, the doorways all sat at least 3 feet off the ground. The contractor had whipped out crude steps so that the front door and one of the side doors were accessible. Once every 2 weeks, usually on a Friday, the family would load into the station wagon and take a trip to town where we would spend the night in a motel so that we could do the laundry and take hot showers, a real improvement over the warm sponge baths that were our usual morning routines. Since we were at the very end of the rural road, our school van was driven by the wife of one of the ranchers who lived nearby. The last half mile of the road to our house was gravel, so we would walk to the pavement where the school van awaited. There were only 6 to 8 of us that relied on the bus, and all the other riders had been born and raised on that road their entire lives. To say we felt like outsiders was an understatement. They were all cordial to us, but they had all known each other their entire lives, so accepting total strangers into their tight-knit group was not forthcoming. Two of the writers were a brother and a sister. Tim was in my sister Susan's grade, and his sister Pat was in my sister Elena's grade. Tim's and Pat's parents, Jack and Margaret, owned the Diestel Turkey Ranch. Since it was the dead of winter, there were no turkeys to be found. As work on the house progressed, creature comforts were beginning to return. I still remember the day the first toilet was installed. There still were no walls, but the fact that going to the bathroom did not involve a hike was reason for celebration. The other great accomplishment was the connecting of electricity to the house. The heaters would now work, and bare light bulbs would replace the kerosene camping lanterns that we had been using since our arrival to light the rooms at night. Cooking was still done on the camping stove, as the rest of the furniture would not arrive until the culvert was repaired and the trucks could make it up the last part of the hill to the house. The downstairs walls were beginning to be sheetrocked, and some of the cabinetry was starting to appear in the kitchen. As spring arrived, the turkeys soon followed. They arrived as day-old chicks from the breeders around the 1st of May. The Diestels raised their turkeys free-range, decades before the practice would become common. Jack also mixed his own feed and never used growth hormones. The turkeys would spend their first couple of months in the brooder houses until they were mature enough to be moved to pasture. My first experience at the ranch was the herding of the young turkeys from the brood houses to the pastures. All of the local kids would help. At dusk, we formed a line, each of us armed with a flag on a 3-foot pole in each hand. We would stand 10 feet apart, waving the flags, herding the turkeys to their new home by making soft clucking noises to urge them along. One of the odd things about turkeys is that after they spend one night out in the pastures, they forget that the brood houses had been their home, and they make no attempt to return to them. However, that means we had to stay with the turkeys until they fell asleep, just after dark. To encourage them to settle down, we would sing to them. The music calmed them and hastened their sleep. I still have fond memories of the surreal image of 7 or 8 people standing out in a pasture serenading 1,000 turkeys at sunset. It took a full week to move the occupants of the 7 brood houses to their assigned pastures. The flocks were separated by sex, and the toms were kept out of sight from the hens. We would all occasionally be asked to help to move the flocks to larger pastures or other non-technical tasks, which we would gladly agree to. It was this interaction that started to break down the barriers into the local group. My senior year in high school, Jack asked me if I would like to help with the processing at Thanksgiving. In those days, almost all of the flocks were wholesaled out to the large processors in the Central Valley. But Jack would keep 100 or so to sell to the locals. This meant the ones held back had 6 to 7 extra weeks to develop. That time made all the difference in the world. The added maturity resulted in the turkeys developing natural fat layers that would make them self-basting. It also meant that they would grow much larger than your average turkey. Dressed weights for hens could easily climb into the mid-20s, and the weight of toms could reach 35 pounds. Those early years were really a mom-and-pop operation. The turkeys kept had to be pre-ordered, and only a couple of extras for those emergency last-minute beggings. After the turkeys were processed, they spent a night soaking in vats of cold water to chill them thoroughly. Early the next morning, and I do mean early, the crew would gather in the converted garage/packing plant, and the assigning would begin. There were 2 refrigerated trucks standing by. One was to contain the turkeys for delivery, and the other for those that were to be picked up. Margaret would be the master of ceremonies with her box of index cards in hand. After the birds had been stuffed with the giblets and vacuum-sealed into plastic bags, they would be weighed, the weight recorded on the bag, and then sent to me. I was the wrapper. Rolls and rolls of white butcher paper in front of me, I would tear off the appropriate length, call out the weight to Margaret, wrap and tape the package, and write the weight of the bird on the paper wrapping, as Margaret would call out a name, and I would write that name next to the weight. Margaret and I would take turns running the birds to the appropriate truck, which were lined with shelves that were assigned the letters of the alphabet. It turned out that that first year, I had proved to be the only person who could rap as fast as the birds arrived. Margaret was amazed and appreciative of my skill, as usually the person in charge of rapping would still be working 2 hours after the rest of the crew was finished, which meant that Margaret was still working as well. It seems incredulous in this day and age, with technology so pervasive, that just 40-some years ago the techniques were so primitive. But I have fond memories of those early years on the turkey ranch. I loved the hands-on approach the experience provided me, a young man who had never had to get his hands dirty to earn a salary. Jack and Margaret were exceptionally kind and generous people. They never hesitated to thank you for a job well done. The work on the ranch was hard, very hard, and physically demanding, and immensely rewarding. I continued to help the Diestels at the Thanksgiving processing all through college and beyond. As the reputation of the Diestel turkeys grew, Jack would keep more and more of the flock back for the locals. You only had to eat a Diestel turkey once to be hooked. My responsibilities at the ranch shifted over time, and with the addition of more sophisticated equipment. By the time the first dedicated processing plant was built, I had moved into the actual processing area. The crews continued to grow, and we would often spend the night sleeping on the Diestel's living room floor in sleeping bags. As the demand for the turkeys grew, the workday grew longer, as all the processing had to be done the week prior to Thanksgiving. I had started bringing my thank you turkey, a gift from the Diestels, back to San Luis Obispo with me, and I soon had friends ask me to bring one back for them. As word spread here, locally, I had more and more requests for Diestel turkeys. For years, even after I was no longer able to help in the processing, I would make an overnight trip to Sonora to get the turkeys. The list became so vast that I made deliveries to people that I knew only by that Thanksgiving tradition. My last year of driving up to Sonora to get turkeys, I brought back 143, and I had to borrow a friend's pickup truck as my van was now too small. After graduating from Cal Poly, I returned to my parents' house for a year to decide what I wanted to do with my life. In January of 1976, Jack hired me to work on the ranch, which I did until July of that year. It was an intense course in poultry ranch management that gave me a greater appreciation for people who make their living off of the land. The Diestel turkey continues to be a part of my Thanksgiving tradition. Fortunately, they are now carried by a local grocer, so a trek to the Sierra Nevada foothills is no longer required. And, in a way, I miss it. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would like to thank today's guest storyteller, Zed Harbor. The two shows in December will be dedicated to remembering one of the cornerstones of the art world here in San Luis Obispo, Myron Graham, and, of course, his wife Priscilla. Please join Krista and I and a panel of guests, Kevin O'Connor, Gail Johnson, longtime employee of Graham's art store Jim Carl, and Myron and Priscilla's son, Robert Graham. This is Stephen DeLuque, and you have been listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo. For co-host Krista Hewitt and I, thank you so very much for listening, and have a very, very happy Thanksgiving holiday.